I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The House passed the bipartisan infrastructure plan last week, a key component of President Biden's agenda, which he is outselling to the public. The $1.2 trillion bill includes $550 billion in new spending for things like roads and bridges, rail, ports, airports, water systems, the power grid, broadband, electric cars, and more. Our infrastructure has been in a sorry state for years, with the American Society of Civil Engineers giving the country a C- in 2021, noting that 43% of public roadways are in poor or mediocre condition. Today on Radio Times, what's the best way to spend all that money to improve our infrastructure? We'll talk with former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, who has been arguing for decades about improving the country's infrastructure. We'll also talk with Leslie Richard, she's general manager of SEPTA, about what percent of the $39 billion earmarked for public transportation the agency will get and how they plan to spend it. And staying with us for the full hour is Robert Puentes. He's the president of the Eno Center for Transportation. That's a nonprofit working on improving transportation policy and leadership. And Robert Puentes, whenever we hear the word infrastructure, we think of you. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
That's really nice.
Nice to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. This infrastructure bill has been compared to the Transcontinental Railroad. I saw a reference to the interstate highway system. Is that hyperbole, or is this something really consequential?
No, this is certainly consequential. As you mentioned at the beginning, after months of negotiations and literally years of false starts, we're very close to having this infrastructure law. It's easily the biggest infrastructure package in decades. And while money isn't everything, it's not really the best way to measure the impact of all of this. With total spending levels around $1 trillion, a little bit more, it's easily comparable to the average levels that we were spending during the New Deal. So it is safe to call this, at least from a spending standpoint, a generational investment.
And the question is where it gets spent and what's the impact. And I do want to get to that. How do you define infrastructure? Because I know there's some people that say it's roads and bridges, but clearly this is so much more.
It's so much more. And that is normally what folks think. I run a transportation organization, and we talk a lot about roads, bridges, airports, public transit, bikes, sidewalks, all these things we commonly associate with infrastructure. Water is commonly associated with infrastructure, but it is much more expansive. Things like the electric grid, things like clean energy, things like telecommunications. There's so much in here because we all know that infrastructure is all designed to work together. All these sectors actually have impacts on one another. It's in the stovepipe world of public policy where we keep these things apart and separated. So a really cool thing about what they're doing here is bringing all this together under this big, massive package.
I'm curious how you think the pandemic, and perhaps it's too soon to tell, will change or is changing the way we use transportation, whether we're, you know, taking a bus somewhere or whether we're driving or whether we're on a bicycle.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's actually is highly relevant to what happens next, because, you know, we have all this money, but the federal government doesn't really choose where a lot of it goes. There's some discretionary money in here, which we can talk about, but a lot of the decisions, a lot of the project ideas all comes from the cities, states, and metropolitan areas all across the country. And so while we're living right now through massive changes in travel behavior, right, some of this is certainly COVID related, and I believe that a lot of it's going to go back to where we were before, but not all of it, right? And so what does that mean then for new investments? As you mentioned at the beginning, the problem we have in this country is that we haven't really rehabilitated, maintained, and taken care of the infrastructure that's already in place. And so the hope is, even though the bill doesn't do that, the hope is that the folks who are making the decisions on where this money ultimately goes will prioritize the need to modernize and upkeep what's on the ground right now. And the folks in the Northeast know this better than anybody else. The infrastructure is not designed to last in perpetuity. It has to be maintained and fixed. And hopefully that's what this infrastructure bill is going to pay a lot of attention to.
That's your hope, which is let's fix it before we expand it?
In many cases, it's a big country, and what's happening in southeastern Pennsylvania is not the same thing that's happening in metropolitan Phoenix, for example. But we know from decades of where we have spent money in the past what these infrastructure investments, particularly in new transportation infrastructure, particularly roads, can do to patterns of growth and development, especially important in fast-growing parts of the country, like the Southwest. So we can learn these lessons, we can understand what we want these infrastructure investments to do, and then we can change based on these new priorities we have, as you mentioned, for the 21st century. This isn't just about building roads so that cars can drive on them. We're investing in this infrastructure for a reason, to help fix climate, to improve public safety, to heal wounds from social equity concerns, economic growth. Like, all these things are derivative of what the infrastructure investments are designed to do. That's what I hope happens with this massive infrastructure package.
It's called the American Jobs Plan. I believe that is the correct name, as it is now, official. What kind of jobs do you anticipate?
Yeah, this Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. It's a good way
it's
to frame it.
It's kind of a clunky name, but go ahead.
It really is. They got to work on the acronym. IIJ is not a great one, but infrastructure jobs are very prevalent in this country. It's about 11%, about 12% of all U.S. jobs are somehow directly related to infrastructure, not secondary jobs that come from the activity that occurs, but directly employed in infrastructure. And they're good jobs. They're actually, most of them, some of them are union jobs in some cases. They come with training, and they pay pretty well, particularly at the lower end of the scale. And so as we're going through a big reckoning about workforce here in this country, and as we're losing a lot of jobs, particularly in the service sector, there's a promise that could come with this infrastructure package that it could be used to help put people back to work and to put them in new careers, right? Especially in transportation, and like I said, especially at the lower end of the income scale, where these jobs actually are pretty attractive.
The idea that instead of working in a hotel or a restaurant, you could be helping to build I-95 or repave I-95.
Sure, it could be construction jobs. There's a lot of jobs that are related to operating vehicles. Some of the work that we've done in recent years has shown that it's really not just about construction jobs, but a lot of these jobs in infrastructure are operating in the system, the things that infrastructure is designed to do. So, in 2009, when we had investments in the stimulus package, which was designed to get folks back to work, these shovel-ready kind of jobs, those were designed to address the loss of construction jobs. It's just a different frame for the workforce 20 years later.
I believe it's $110 billion then earmarked for roads and bridges. Looking at the need to improve our roads and bridges, does that come close to being enough money?
It's hard to say. It depends on what we do with them. I mean, these estimates are so big and so broad. It's the best shot that we have. But we also need to make sure that, as I said, we're paying attention to what needs to be fixed right now, what the most urgent stuff is. And so there's a lot of folks who say, no, it's not enough, that this is a good down payment on what we need to do. But if we're spending this new money on things like new investments, on new roadways, for example, and we're not fixing what's on the ground, then we're still back into the cycle that we were in before. So I'd love to see this money go to those priority needs, and then we'll figure out where we are then, and then hopefully we'll get more money to do more work after that, because it's a big country, it's a growing country, and we're going to need these investments into the future.
I mentioned I-95 near Philadelphia. Frankly, Robert Puentes, I've lost track about how long that has been under construction, widening it. I understand it's really hard to widen a road, especially a big highway like I-95, while people are using it. But nonetheless, we're talking about, I guess in some cases, a multi-year project.
Yeah, a lot of these are. And this is what's coming up now, is folks want to see, okay, we passed the bill, the president hasn't signed it yet, but when are we going to start seeing the impact? And it does take time, right? As we mentioned, the stimulus package in 2008-2009, had this phrase shovel ready. It was designed to do things really, really fast because we were losing, 800,000 jobs a month or
That's
something.
Right.
It was a very, very different fiscal environment. We do have a little bit more time to think about these and to make sure we're making the right kind of investments that that have massive impacts on how communities grow and develop, on their economies, on the people, and all this kind of stuff. And so we have a little bit more time. A lot of the money is going to go out pretty soon, and it's going to go into existing programs there is money that just goes out as straight grants. You mentioned the $550 billion in new spending that's in this package. But the other piece of what's in here is a reauthorization of a mix of existing transportation and water laws that just extends for a bunch more years. So those haven't changed. It just goes back into feeding those same programs, which is fine. But again, it depends on what places want to do with that grant money. That's really going to make the difference on what the ultimate outcome of all this investment is.
Let me pick up on something that you referenced. There is $1 billion to, reconnect inner city neighborhoods that were cut off by things like freeways and transportation lines. These were in a sense, designed to disconnect Black and brown communities from larger cities. If you could speak to that, the importance of that. It's $1 billion.
Yeah, and it's one of the coolest parts, I think, of this 1,000-page law. And it's something that we've talked about for a number of years. Some communities have tried to address it, but it's expensive. Taking down some of these elevated freeways, some of these massive boulevards that, as you mentioned, in generations past had cut through, the path of least resistance, to coin a phrase, which was mostly through Black and brown communities or low-income neighborhoods. And devastated these areas. And while we associate transportation infrastructure with improving access, in many cases, it actually hindered access. And former Secretary Fox tells a great story about when he was growing up in Charlotte, North Carolina, that they had a massive elevated freeway that was separated his neighborhood from where all the wealth and opportunity was in that city. And wow, that's the stuff that this bill, or this part of the bill, is designed to address. How can we use this money? And $1 billion sounds like a lot, but it's a big job to right size those urban roadways, whether it's taking them down, making them more pedestrian friendly, so that they're connecting communities as opposed to slicing through them, whether it's just taking them down completely, like has been proposed in a bunch of other places. It's really going to depend on the situation in these different cities. But it's a really, really interesting proposal and something that we're going to watch very, very closely. I think it's going to have a big impact on cities.
And it just shows you, we're almost up on a break here, but it shows you how infrastructure is more than roads and bridges. It's about public policy and some of the deleterious impacts of some public policies.
Yeah, and using this to take down existing infrastructure, I think, is a really innovative idea.
And that is Robert Puentes. He's going to stay with us for the hour on Radio Times. We're talking about infrastructure and the fact that the House passed a bipartisan infrastructure plan last week. The president is out selling this plan. And Robert Puentes is president, CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. That's a nonprofit think tank with the mission of improving transportation policy. Waiting in the wings is Leslie Richard. She's the general manager and CEO for SEPTA. We'll be talking about public transportation as part of this infrastructure bill. And we want to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking with Robert Puentes. He's the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation, about the infrastructure bill passed by the U.S. Senate this summer and passed by the House last week. The overall price tag is $1.2 trillion, with about half of that money in new spending. Public transportation is getting $39 billion, and we asked Leslie Richards, the general manager of SEPTA, that's Philadelphia's public transportation agency, to join us and tell us about where SEPTA's portion of that money will be invested. And Leslie Richards, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty, especially talking about money.
Exactly. It's been a little while, right? How much of this $39 billion is SEPTA going to get? Do you know?
Yeah, look, we're still learning more about the final numbers in the bill, but based on what we do know, it looks like it's going to provide for us over $120 million in new funding for capital improvements in the first year, and that will increase approximately to about $150 million in the fifth year. But we're really encouraged and excited about a number of new funding programs and initiatives that could truly enhance SEPTA service. As you know, we're an old legacy system. We have a lot of state of good repair projects. And we're really excited about the new $1.75 billion Station Accessibility Competitive Grant Program. Here at SEPTA, we have a really good story to tell regarding our station accessibility efforts. I'm proud of what we've done so far with the City of Philadelphia and on our subway lines in particular, our Market Frankfurt, our Broad Street line stations, making them fully accessible over the next decade. And then there's also a new $1.5 billion competitive grant for rail vehicle replacement that we are very excited about. It, again, as a legacy system and having one of the oldest rail vehicle fleets in the nation, that could really, really help us.
A lot of money, even beyond this transportation, this infrastructure money coming to SEPTA. To you, Robert Puentes, we're going to focus on SEPTA for a couple of minutes here, but broadly speaking, looking across the country, what are the needs for public transit for this, for the country?
Public transit, as Leslie said, certainly needs state of good repair projects, especially in the Northeast, and as Leslie mentioned, especially for legacy projects, the ones that were around well before the interstate highway system, places like Boston, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, right? So fixing what's broken in those places is a big need. You know, here in metropolitan Washington, we're going through some of these struggles right now with the rail system. And then throughout the country, there are, you know, as we said at the beginning, where places are growing, you know, the Southeast and the Southwest parts of the country, places like Austin and Seattle up in the Pacific Northwest have large expansion projects to their rail system, which is designed to accommodate the growth and development that they're expecting over the next few decades. And so making sure that those places can grow in the ways that they want, ways that are sustainable, ways that meet the climate goals, ways that meet their social equity and inclusion goals, is really important for this transit money. It could have a huge impact on the future of those regions.
Well, Leslie Richards, let me go back to you. And I know light rail extension, that's certainly something that SEPTA has been working on. What's the status of that? And does this money in any way help make that closer to a reality?
Absolutely. So King of Prussia Rail is a huge project for us. It is an extension. It'll be the first time we are ever going to the federal government for what they call New Starts programs. SEPTA has never been in that position before. It's a milestone for us and obviously very important to our system that we can extend. We can reach the third largest employer in the region. It would connect Center City, University City, and King of Prussia, and you know, provide those opportunities. That's what public transit does, is it provides opportunities for people, connecting them to employment, allowing them to get around to where they need to be. And so this is a huge project for us. And then the new grant program will allow us to compete for those dollars, and there's more money than they've ever had before for projects like King of Prussia Rail.
Mm. Do you have a timeline? Do you think, I mean, assuming everything falls into place, so when would this be completed?
Well, we're going to be, we're already talking to the federal government right now about getting into the pipeline for the federal grant application. We just passed a project development stage, which is a huge deal for us. And look, if we get onto an aggressive timeline, all the funding falls into place, we would see this being built around 2025.
Wow. Let me go back to you, Robert Puentes. I was reading that something like 45% of Americans have no access to public transit. Does that square with your understanding?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways to measure it, but it is pretty bleak in many parts of the country. It's different in the Northeast. These places grew up before the advent of the highway system. But in many parts of the country, yes. And the challenge we have in many regions is that it's also where the most affordable housing is. So you have this double whammy of having folks without transit access to jobs and economic opportunity who are then required literally to own and operate a car because they have no other way to get around. And that's the second largest household expense for most American households. And so it's very, very difficult when these two things are coupled together. The hope then with a lot of this new money and a lot of this new thinking and a lot of this new framing for what infrastructure is designed to do is that connecting up people, providing that access, especially for folks who are low income, would be a huge benefit from this money.
Leslie Richards, let me go back to you. And I was talking with Robert Puentes about the impact of the COVID pandemic on transportation. As someone that uses transportation in Philadelphia and also the regional rails, it was pretty obvious what was happening. How much has SEPTA recovered?
We're just about 50% of pre-pandemic levels on our ridership. When we talk about regional rail, we're just around 30% of pre-pandemic ridership. We have a ways to go as businesses figure out their return to office plans, as people get more comfortable to travel. And, we're still losing about $1 million a day.
Whoa.
At the fare box. Yeah, it has hit us, and we're very, very grateful for the COVID relief money that has come out of Washington. We're very, very grateful, obviously, to our elected officials here in southeastern Pennsylvania for helping us out there. But there's no scenario that we've run where our ridership comes back before that COVID relief money runs out. And so we're really taking a look, just like many transit agencies across the country, at everything we do and how can we be as efficient with the money that we have. And, we have about 2 years to figure it out and what the future of transit will look like.
Wow, that's a lot of money to be losing every day. Robert Puentes, mm-hmm. Is that true for other transit systems in the country?
Yeah, it certainly is. And Leslie was certainly right that this is clearly an area where the federal government did come to the rescue and provided a lifeline for transit all across the country, not just for the people who rely on the services, but on the workforce in these agencies, which is substantial in many cases. But it also highlights a really important point between the difference between the transit modes and the folks who use them. And in many cases, we see that commuter rail, these long-distance services, the regional rail, I guess, in the Southeast Philly,
right.
Had huge, huge drops in ridership because these are mostly white-collar workers coming in from the suburbs to downtowns who had the ability, the luxury to work from home. And so big, big drops in that. But for inner-city rail projects and for bus in particular, we didn't see those same kind of drops, right? And it really illustrates that the service that the bus was providing, especially for folks who had no other alternative, who were essential workers in many cases. And so when we think about the future, we think about what transit's going to look like, investments in the bus network, which has long been neglected, I'm not saying in Southeast Philly, but I think across the country, is really important. And there's lots of fixes that can happen with bus-only lanes and signal priority and improved stations and stops and all this stuff to make bus the mode of choice in the future. There's a lot of opportunities here for agencies that are going to do that.
And that's Robert Puentes. He's the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. Also with us is Leslie Richards. She's general manager and CEO for SEPTA and was a former PennDOT secretary. We are talking about infrastructure today on Radio Times. After some wrangling in Congress, a bill was passed at the end of last week, $1.2 trillion in spending on infrastructure. We're focusing in this portion of Radio Times on public transportation. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. If you use public transit here in Philadelphia, SEPTA being the operative word, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Leslie Richards, I know part of this infrastructure bill has to do with climate, the impact of climate change on our infrastructure. Was SEPTA hurt by some of these big storms?
Absolutely. Look, we're seeing storms with an intensity. That seems to be, the pattern now. These are not the storms I saw growing up. And so they hit hard. They bring flooding. They destabilize, slopes. We have a lot of regional rail, particularly that's along rivers. We got a lot of rivers here, especially along the Schuylkill River. And damage. Look, we were very lucky with just this latest storm with Ida. It could have been much more detrimental and damaging to our system, but it really was just luck of how it hit and where it hit. And the flooding it continues to be a problem. Resiliency in our projects and in our assets is also an issue. Obviously, the majority of our system being built, you know, over 50 years ago, and you know, not always built in the best places where we're seeing some of these really hard storms come in.
Yeah.
And so we're making sure that we design, that we build, we construct, we're using materials differently. Obviously, we're working with our colleagues across the country. We share best practices, you know, how we can make the entire transit system throughout the country. Obviously, we're very interested in here in southeastern Pennsylvania as resilient as possible.
And turning back to you, Robert Puentes, I remember, I believe it was Hurricane Sandy, seeing, and this was, about a decade ago, some of the subway systems in New York with water just gushing into the system. I was just taking public transportation in New York, the subway system. You know, it's hard to compare what it was 10 years ago, but nonetheless, how vulnerable is public transportation to some of these climate threats?
Very, very vulnerable. And those pictures are indelible.
I see them on
social media. Yeah, water streaming downstairs and, you know, through grates and things like that. So it's a big job, you know, hardening our existing infrastructure, public transit especially, to make it withstand these weather events in the future. It has to be a priority. And there's money in here to help do that. We also need to make sure that we're dealing with the climate challenge broadly to begin with, right? Transportation is the number one emitter of greenhouse gases. And so while there's a lot of good programs in here to do things like build out electric vehicle infrastructure to help, you know, boost that market so that we have you know, clean vehicles that are driving around, there's also some attention that's got to be placed to making sure that we don't have to rely on vehicles in the first place. And so that's the part where it gets back to what we were talking about before, is it really depends then on what places are going to do with that money. Are they going to embrace a low carbon future by investing in alternative modes, in public transit, in biking and walking? Or is it going to be business as usual in some places? That's going to be the real test in the future.
Here's a comment from David for you. Leslie Richards says, what can be done to combat the drug use problem on the L? This is obviously, or maybe it is related to infrastructure. I don't know. He goes on to say, I take it often and almost see 3 to 4 people, even in the middle of a business day. I've even witnessed people shooting up in front of everyone. I feel for these lost souls and I want to get them help, but this is scaring riders away. Can this money be used to increase security or maybe even help for some of these drug users? What do you say?
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank him for, you know, saying that he feels for these people, because we want to be very compassionate. The pandemic has really pushed people, especially, you know, in the Philadelphia area. And, you know, we do see it. I'm very proud of what we're doing. In fact, I'm at a national conference right now, and we're talking about our program of where we are pairing with different agencies and partnering with our transit police, with social workers, with addiction specialists. We're with healthcare agencies, and where we are truly compassionately engaging with members of our vulnerable population, offering them information of where they can get treatment, how they can get treatment, being as helpful as we can. Obviously, we'd love to see them go into transitional housing and accept that, as well as into permanent housing. And so it's becoming a national model, what we are doing here at SEPTA. It's called our SCOPE program, and it's for safety. It's for cleanliness. It's for ownership, partnerships, engagement. That's what it stands for. And people are taking note. We've been asked to talk about it, and we are helping people. It's very small and incremental. We're working with the city of Philadelphia, and we're working with many other partners in the area. It really is going to take a community effort. SEPTA wants to be part of the solution, and we're working on that, but it is an overwhelming societal problem where transit can help, but obviously we need to partners with others.
Sure. I mean, Robert Puentes, and we're talking about transit and social service agencies teaming up together to help this problem, a national problem.
Indeed, and I just echo what Leslie said. It's not just at the feet of public transit. It's very unfair to put it at the feet of public transit to be the ones to solve this problem. But as Leslie said, that what they're doing in Philadelphia is a national model, and the joining up of social services and transit provision is something that I'd like to see other places do. But it gets to where we started at the beginning, that these issues around infrastructure and transportation are all intertwined with other things like housing and affordable housing, and you know, parts on the coast and in California, which are struggling with huge housing challenges right now. It manifests itself in lots of different ways. It may be problematic for transit agencies and for the system, but it's not just a transit or a transportation solution. A lot of this comes down to housing and some of these other things. So it does take, as Leslie said, a broader societal response, not just from a transit perspective.
Leslie, we're almost having a break here and have to say goodbye to you, but I just want to read you this email from Erica. I use SEPTA's buses in the Broad Street line. Mask compliance is iffy on the buses and subway. Under those circumstances, if I didn't have to use SEPTA, I would not. Is there any way to remedy this and thereby attract more riders back to SEPTA in a minute or less? Yeah, go ahead, Leslie.
Yeah. Masks are required on our system. There's signage everywhere. People are being reminded. And, everyone must wear masks, our employees as well as our customers. We remind people we don't want our employees to get into confrontations. So we want to protect, obviously, the safety of everybody. But please remind everybody, we do everything that we can to remind everybody to wear masks, and let's keep everybody safe. That's something we've learned from this pandemic, that we can all look out for each other.
Well, Leslie Richards, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's general manager and CEO for SEPTA. That's the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority. And they are getting some money from this infrastructure bill that was passed last week by the House of Representatives. We're talking about what's in the bill, how it could or should be spent. Robert Puente is staying with us for the rest of the hour, president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. And we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're also calling former Governor Ed Rendell. He's got some thoughts about infrastructure. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Robert Puentes. He's the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. That's a nonprofit think tank with a mission of improving transportation policy. And we're talking about what's in this infrastructure bill that was passed, more than $1 trillion invested in things like roads and bridges, the power grid, ports, railroads, water safety, internet access, public transit, electric vehicles, and more. And we hope to be hearing from Governor Rendell in a couple of minutes. But in the meantime, let me pick up on a couple of things that you mentioned, Robert Puentes. First, about e-vehicles. They're the electric vehicle chargers and infrastructure are going to get $7.5 billion from this infrastructure bill. Do you see that? First of all, how much of a game changer do you think that will be?
It's a lot. I think it's going to fall a little bit short of the president's target of 500,000 chargers, which is what he's looking for, which I think is basically eventually trying to replace the number of gasoline pumps we have with electric vehicle chargers. And it's a challenge, right? I mean, we know that the adoption of electric vehicles requires the ability for folks to have comfort that they can charge the vehicle, so they're not going to get stranded. Range anxiety and all those phrases we're familiar with. So this is going to go to help that quite a bit. $2.5 billion that's going to go to grants for charging infrastructure that can facilitate that adoption. But it's a multi-actor effort, right? The federal government has a big role to play here, and they can use their spending power and their procurement power to electrify their own fleet, and hopefully that'll help stimulate the market. You know, but there's a lot of this stuff that needs to come from the private sector, whether it's new developments, and kind of renovations of existing public infrastructure. And at the same time, we've got to make sure that we're not just putting it in areas where you're going to see folks who have the means and the resources to buy electric vehicles, which are really expensive.
They are.
So, you know, how do we make sure that this money is also going into low-income neighborhoods and focusing on electric buses and other kinds of fleets that everybody can use, and not just those who can afford really expensive electric vehicles?
Well, I mentioned the former Governor Ed Rendell will be joining us. He has been sounding the alarm about our crumbling infrastructure for decades. Back in 2008, he teamed up with then New York City Mayor Bloomberg and then California Governor Schwarzenegger to create a nonprofit, Building America's Future, calling for more than $1 trillion in spending on roads and bridges, on rail lines, on ports, aviation, dams, energy, and more. Well, they got their wish 13 years later with this new infrastructure bill. And we asked Governor Rendell to share his thoughts about this new bill and how it should be spent. And Governor, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Sure, nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. And I should say that you are with Robert Puentes, who is the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. So was it worth the wait, Governor, for your $1.2 trillion?
Well, Robert, let me just say, Robert's been working on this almost as long as I have. I started out when I was mayor. I accepted the chairmanship of a nonprofit called Rebuild America that was dedicated to getting us to do real infrastructure spending. Look, there's good news and not such good news in this. The good news is this is the most significant spending on the American infrastructure since Dwight Eisenhower put in the interstate highway system in the early 50s. So for that reason alone, mm-hmm. it's a reason to celebrate. We have never dedicated this much money for infrastructure at one time. Now, although the money is going to be stretched out over several years, the work can start beginning to be undertaken. Probably there'll be projects in the ground in 4 or 5 months. It'll have a great effect on the economy. It'll create a lot of a couple of million good-paying jobs. It's needed in every state and every area that they addressed. We need help, no question about it.
That's a good
question. Is it?
That's the good side. What's the bad side?
Well, the bad side is if you look at this bill, everyone says, "Well, it's $1.2 trillion." Well, people don't realize that folded in that is the normal highway trust fund spending. The normal spending over this time period would be about $500 billion. So it's really only $700 billion of new money over a 6-7 year period. When you look at it this way, it's good funding, but it's not what, for example, the American Society of Civil Engineers say that we should be spending $200 billion a year more than we're currently spending. Well, we're only going to be winding up spending a little more than half of that. But look, you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. This is a tremendous achievement by the Biden administration. You know, Donald Trump had both houses. He had the Congress and the Senate. And for 4 years, we heard about Infrastructure Week and infrastructure and this and that. And they never even put a bill before the Congress. So this is a very significant achievement. The plan's well thought out. It touches all the things that the hard infrastructure of this country need: expanded broadband, help with the electrical grid.
Sure. And let me because we have Robert Puentes here, and you're one of the people behind Infrastructure Week. Do I have that right, Robert Puentes?
You're dating me now.
I am dating you, but yeah, he started it. What can I say?
We started this many years ago with folks like Governor Rendell and others who were working on these issues well before the Trump administration made it a talking point, which was really designed to collect all of the folks who were interested in these issues and bring it all together so we can collectively advocate for what we all thought was important. And as you mentioned, a number of years later, we finally got it done. But it just shows how the policymaking happens in Washington and just how long some of these things can take.
Well, let me ask you a partisan question, Governor Rendell. As I mentioned, you know, you worked with Governor Schwarzenegger, Mayor Bloomberg, and an independent, I think, at the time, and a Republican on infrastructure. And now we're hearing that the Republican Party wants to punish 13 Republicans who voted for this infrastructure bill, possibly removing them from committee assignments. It includes Representative Brian Fitzpatrick in Bucks County outside of Philadelphia, I believe one of the only Republicans representing the suburbs around Philadelphia. What do you make of how did infrastructure become so partisan?
Well, because everything has become so partisan. It's terrible. But one thing, if they want to do that and punish the Republican members who did that, I want them to agree to send out a directive that no Republican who didn't vote for the infrastructure bill can come to a groundbreaking of any infrastructure projects in their district. Because what happened during the Obama stimulus is there was a lot of money for infrastructure, not anywhere near this, but Republicans who voted against the stimulus and voted against the infrastructure funding showed up to help cut the ribbon. It was the most hypocritical thing I've ever seen. We didn't call them on it. We were too polite to call them on it. I think we should call every one of them who does that because people want a good infrastructure. Infrastructure is vitally important to the quality of our lives. It's vitally important to public safety, and it's vitally important to a good robust economy, and everybody's in favor of infrastructure, particularly projects in their home area. So we don't want these guys to be complete frauds and show up to celebrate something that they voted against.
What do you make of that, Robert Puentes? I know you're more about infrastructure than politics, but it's hard to separate the two.
Yeah, well, especially in Washington these days. And infrastructure has always been not just bipartisan, but nonpartisan, right? There's the saying that there's no Republican roads, no Democrat bridges, and it's really true. And it's something very different that happens in Washington than what happens outside. I mean, the states and cities and metropolitan areas still are in charge of doing a lot on the infrastructure space. They raise a ton of money themselves, either with the legislatures and at the ballot box. And so especially in the West and in the Southwest, communities go to their voters every election day and ask them to vote for billions and billions of dollars in infrastructure spending. And they do this very, very regularly. So, you know, to say that it's this political thing, it's just the nonsense that is enveloping Washington right now. For a real look at, I think, at what's happening politically with infrastructure, you have to look outside the Capitol Beltway and see what's happening in the real world. And it's just very different than the rhetoric in Washington.
Governor Rendell, we have to say goodbye to you, but we've been talking about all the things that are included in this infrastructure bill, and it is a long list. From your perspective, what is the top priority for this region of the country?
For our region of the country, my top priority would be high-speed rail, real high-speed rail. And when I'm talking about real high-speed rail, I'm talking about 240 miles an hour like the French and British and Spanish and Japanese have, and maybe even a maglev train that's now being constructed and is in a partial operation in Japan that goes 317 miles an hour, Marty. Can you imagine if you could get from Philadelphia to New York, station to station, in 24 minutes, Philadelphia to Washington in 36 minutes? Well, the maglev train can do that. And that would not only have an effect of taking cars off the road, but we could get rid of all of the airline shuttles, which do nothing but clog the airways and make the ordinary needed flights much shorter time and less traffic in the sky. It would do so much for the Northeast Corridor. And we've got to get it because our highway system can't expand and take in any more cars. And by the way, taking those cars off the road is about the best thing we could do for our environment.
We got to leave it there. Governor Rendell, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And he's co-chair of the Building America's Future. That's a coalition formed to increase transportation spending. Let me pick up on that, Robert Puentes, because I ran across a quote from you, and the governor was talking about high-speed rail along this Northeast Corridor, very crowded Northeast Corridor. You say Amtrak was set up to fail. It wasn't designed to last as long as it has. Can we have the kind of high-speed rail that the governor was talking about in Japan or in Europe along this very crowded corridor?
Yeah, we can. I mean, the quote was really designed, was focused on when Amtrak was created in the early 1970s. You know, it has survived from year after year, and clearly there's a some kind of rail renaissance that's going on now, and President Biden, you know, so associated right. with his Amtrak use. And the money that's in here for Amtrak is transformative. It's more funds than have been cumulatively invested in Amtrak over the first 50 years of its history. So, you know, just using spending again as a measure, there's a lot in here. You know, the challenge in the Northeast Corridor is that this is where we started, is that we've got to fix some of this existing right. infrastructure. There is a tunnel in the city of Baltimore that's a real pinch point for Amtrak because it has to crawl through this say ancient, but someone was telling me the other day it was built during the Grant administration.
What?
Just to give you an idea how old this thing is.
Oh my God.
You know, so we've got to fix that thing. It's really expensive. There's the tunnels under the Hudson River, which, as you mentioned, were damaged during Superstorm Sandy. Huge investments, not just for New York and New Jersey, and not just really for the Northeast, but for the country, because of the economic impact that comes along with it. So, you know, for the Northeast Corridor, it's different because we've got to fix what's on the ground right now. But, you know, if we're going to have this national system, there's a lot of other places where we can see, you know, really effective and efficient rail, whether it's high speed or otherwise. And the projects that are happening in California and in Florida, I think, are good lessons for the rest of the country. But we've got to choose these carefully, and we've got to, yeah. I mean, developing super fast high speed rail, Germany, Japanese style, I think is going to be tough in this country. We have a lot of things in the way between major metropolitan areas,
like infrastructure, like buildings, right?
And buildings and housing, yeah. So I mean, this for that really to work, it's got to be straight, it's got to be flat, you know. And that's just expensive. Land is expensive in this country. I think we're going to get there in some ways, but a lot of the stuff that's in this new bill has really got to go to fixing the existing system.
You know, I was reading that U.S. costs per mile compared to Europe is much more expensive, and I believe it takes a lot longer just to whatever you're doing with infrastructure to lay roadway or perhaps even to lay track. Is that true, Robert Puentes?
It is. In fact, you know, here at the Eno Center for Transportation, we've been working on this for a number of years on the public transit side, and it's really complicated. A lot of people go into it thinking, oh, that's because we have expensive labor. Well, there's expensive labor in lots of parts of Europe where they really do support their workers. Or they say, well, it's environmental laws that take so much, and also not true. Other places with very, very strong environmental laws get things done a lot faster and a lot quicker. So it is complicated. I think part of the problem is that when it comes to public transit, we do try to avoid any kind of contention in places. And so even in a place like New York with such a rich history of transit, the role that transit plays in just keeping that city functioning, there's so many restrictions on when you can build and the noise restrictions and how you accommodate people who are inconvenienced. And all that is really obviously really important, especially for folks who are normally not listened to. But it's just different than what happens in other countries where mm-hmm. everybody recognizes, yes, here in Madrid, you know, we know we're going to be inconvenienced for a couple of years, but when that thing is done, we're going to have this great system that's going to provide us access. And so part of it is cultural, but we're working right now to try to figure out what can we do to squeeze efficiencies out of the existing process so we can get things done better, faster, cheaper. Washington has a role to play in that, but it's going to come down to what cities and metropolitan areas are doing. And to your point, learning from what they do in Europe is a really important element of that.
Well, Robert Puentes, always a pleasure to talk with you about infrastructure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
No, I really appreciate it, too. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And he is the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. We also talked with Leslie Richards, general manager and CEO for SEPTA, and former Pennsylvania governor, former Philadelphia mayor Ed Rendell, about infrastructure. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and you can look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us at WHYY Radio Times on Instagram and Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us.